From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Even cavemen had tabloids. I just discovered that. Zeb seen without underwear under buffalo robe.
That's George Saunders. He'll tell us about his essay, The Braindead Megaphone, today, as we look at the decline and fall of intellectualism in America. Also, is the internet killing our culture?
When you go to Wikipedia, the entry on Stephen Colbert's joke, his notion of truthiness, is almost as long and as meticulously researched as the entry on truth, the core concept in the history of Western philosophy.
And we'll explore the surreal satire of Bear v. Shark, the novel.
Tonight after News 8, join us for our ongoing series, Bear v. Shark, The Tale of the Tape. Tonight we focus on the tongue. Do sharks have one? Tune in at 10:04.
Let's get ready to rumble! Holy cow!
But first, Susan Jacoby. She's the author of The Age of American Unreason. In the book, Jacoby argues that America is dumbing down rather than smartening up. She told Steve Paulson that the inspiration for her book came from an incident on September 11th, 2001.
On September 11th, I was working in the New York Public Library, and like every other New Yorker, I had to walk home that day because the subways weren't running. And like a lot of New Yorkers, I stopped at a bar for a drink. I needed one. And as I was having my drink, you know, there were these two suits in their 30s, briefcases, obviously guys with good jobs. And one of them said, "This feels like Pearl Harbor." And I thought, well, yeah, probably that must be. And the other one says, "What's Pearl Harbor?" And then the first guy says, "Pearl Harbor is when the Vietnamese bombed one of our harbors and started the Vietnam War." And I thought, ooh. I mean, a light bulb didn't flash over my head. I think I've got to write a book about unreason and stupidity in America. But like most writers, I filed it away for future use.
And you didn't just write this off as, wow, that is just shocking ignorance there. But you think that's actually fairly commonplace, that kind of thinking.
Well, thinking is not what I would call it. Maybe that level of ignorance isn't commonplace, but certainly what I did in my book is I picked up where the great historian Richard Hofstadter left off in 1963. And certainly our level of historical knowledge, our knowledge of science, our knowledge of history, including our own, has really fallen off in the last 30 years. I think that there are a lot of reasons for that. Perhaps this is an extreme example, but every survey of every form of knowledge shows that ignorance is common, including among educated people. Look, 2 years ago, National Geographic Roper took a poll of 18 to 25-year-olds, and they found out that the vast majority of them, including those who are college-educated, can't find Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, four countries of obvious, immense importance to American interests on a map. A map, by the way, that's marked with the names of countries.
The names of the countries were on the map and they still couldn't find those countries?
Yes, meaning that they weren't exactly sure of where in the world to look on a map for it. That's the whole point. That's just one example, but there are others. International surveys of 15-year-olds show that we're practically dead last in math in developed countries. We're only mediocre in science, 14 out of 25 countries. I won't even go on about the polls by the National Constitution Center that show that the vast majority of Americans asked to name one First Amendment right. The only one that half can name is freedom of religion. Vast majority of people can't name any others.
So you're saying there is rampant ignorance out there in the United States. But are you saying this is rooted in anti-intellectualism, that there's actually hostility towards intellectual thinking?
And in something new. Look, anti-intellectualism has always been a part of American life. Richard Hofstadter described it, I think, correctly. The traditional forms of anti-intellectualism, some of them are the flip side of some of our best impulses. For example, evangelical religion, which is based on a personal relationship between man and God, is also resistant to Orthodox church hierarchies. But it was also resistant to the secularizing, scientific, and modernizing trends that more liberal religions accepted. Same thing, America got farther more quickly in the democratization of education in the 19th century. This also meant inevitably a lowering of standards that prevailed in countries where only 10% of people were expected to learn to read and write. But I think what's different today from the traditional forms of anti-intellectualism is that they're also melded with anti-rationalism, that during the last 40 years, and particularly during the last 20, there's been a positive contempt for evidence. I think, and the biggest factor in this is something that wasn't such a big factor at all when Hofstadter was writing, which is the infotainment culture.
When you say contempt for evidence, what do you mean?
By contempt for evidence, I mean exactly what we see in everything from foreign policy to discussions for a long time of global warming. Foreign policy, for example, the Iraq War was based on false evidence, which is that Saddam had something to do with 9/11 and that there were WMDs in Iraq. Now, it is possible that a reasonable person who didn't have access to intelligence reports might have believed that Saddam had WMDs, but now we know it wasn't true. And yet, huge numbers of Americans, more than half, still believe Saddam had something to do with 9/11. We're basing public policy not on evidence, but on emotion and passion. In fact, Obama just said that, and it's the first time I've heard somebody say that when we're making decisions about public policy, they need to be based on reason and evidence and not on passion.
So you're really making the case that there is more anti-intellectualism and anti-rationalism in America, more contempt for evidence than in most other developed countries. And I guess the question, the obvious question is, why?
Well, I think there are three main factors. One of them is fundamentalism, which, while it's not a majority phenomenon at all, but one-third of Americans believe in the literal truth of sacred books. This doesn't exist in any other developed country in the world. It doesn't exist in the developed countries of Europe or in Asia. And fundamentalism, and I emphasize not religion, but fundamentalism, is at its core anti-rational, because you can be religious, all kinds of people are, and accept Darwin's theory of evolution, but you can't insist that the earth was created in 6 days and accept Darwin's theory of evolution. So that's one thing, but that's always been with us. The second thing is the 24/7 infotainment culture. Now, that exists all over the world. The interesting question is, why have Americans proven more susceptible to it? And I think part of the reason is that we have always had this immense romance with technology. Over and over, I hear, you know, and I've lectured a good deal in the last month in various places, that computers are making us smarter. This is a part of the American romance with technology. No, they're not. Computers are just a tool. I love computers. I've been called a technophobe, but that's not true. But computers are only a tool. Finding information in computers is important only if you already have a body of knowledge that enables you to judge what's true and what's false. And just being able to swoop down like a vulture in a computer, as I'm sure you and I both do, and find how to spell the names of countries whose names we don't know how to spell, the order of dates in which we've forgotten, if there's not a body of knowledge behind that, computers aren't making us smarter. And in fact, a lot of the things we do on computers, which is basically look at the video culture, are not making us smarter at all. The more time we spend looking at things on screens, the less smart we become, in my view.
How much do you blame American schools in what you see as this rampant anti-intellectualism?
American education has serious failings, and I think that we need to talk less about college, which everybody is obsessed with, how to pay for college, and more about elementary and secondary education. And this is actually related, again, as Hofstadter said, to our best traditions. We're the only country in the developed world that has local and state control of school curricula. If you live, let's say, in Italy, there may be different cultural values in the Piedmont and in Sicily. Sicily. But if you go to high school, you're taught the same things about science and about Italian history wherever you go. This is not true here. In areas of the Midwest and the South, where fundamentalism is strongest, the rural Midwest, the Fordham Foundation has found that only about a third of American schools are doing a decent job of teaching evolution. The reason for that is that local school boards are able to intimidate teachers against using the very word evolution.
So even if there are science teachers who fully accept evolution, they might be too scared to actually teach it in their classroom.
A lot of them are worried. What they do is they substitute phrases like changes over time for evolution, which is very confusing to kids. But it's not science. It's also history. We don't have any national standards for the teaching of history. In other words, there's no agreement on what kids should be taught, a basis, you know, beyond which you obviously build what should be taught about American history. When there was an attempt to develop some national history standards about 15 years ago, the right wing got all up in arms because the first standards were really political correctness run mad. They wanted to change the phrase "we the people" in the Constitution to "we the peoples," as if that was what was written in the Constitution. And two great intellectuals, public intellectuals, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who died and was, of course, very liberal, and Diane Ravitch, who is not dead, who is conservative but bipartisan enough to have served in both the Clinton and the administrations of George H.W. Bush. They endorsed a new set of national history standards, which added a lot more African-American history, women's history, but struck out some of these mad excesses of liberal political correctness. And they got nowhere. We need national curriculum standards, not imposed by the government, but at least presented. And one of the characteristics of intellectual life today is that right-wing and left-wing intellectuals, I would say right-center and left-center, not the real nuts at the extreme ends of the spectrum, it's very difficult for them to cooperate on things like curriculum standards, which logically they ought to be able to. Our public school system is a mess. Look, blaming it on fundamentalist religion is wrong. Two-thirds of Americans say evolution and creationism should be taught, but two-thirds of Americans don't know what DNA is. Now, you should not have to be an intellectual or a college graduate to know that DNA is the key to heredity. That's something everybody should come out of a high school biology class with, and it has nothing to do with fundamentalist religion and everything to do with the fact that our public schools are a mess.
I certainly can understand how teachers and even whole school districts feel like they have to walk on eggshells when it comes to, say, teaching evolution. On the other hand, when it's teaching history, when it's getting at the basic story of the founding of this country, the story of the founding fathers, the Civil War, later wars, I guess I just assume that most schools teach that stuff.
But if they do, they're not succeeding, since over half of 15-year-olds don't know that the Revolutionary War came before the Civil War. I mean, I think the failure to teach logical thinking is beneath all of this. But again, I've heard a lot of right-left dialogue, and the left often says, oh, you just want them to teach facts. No. This, again, the idea that there's an opposition between teaching logical thinking and facts is wrong. They go together. You need to teach people how to think, but they can't know how to think. For example, how to think properly about racial history of this country. You need to know that the Constitution was based on allowing slavery. You have to know that before you can know why the Civil War was fought. But if you don't know that the Constitution was written before the Civil War, it's all a muddle in your head. And what I'm saying, judging from all of these good polls, and these are good, statistically, randomly balanced polls, not junk science and junk thought, as I call it. People don't know these things, so that reasoning and facts go together. They're not in opposition. Just as, for example, in public life, the ability to speak well and to educate and inspire through the way you speak and evidence also go together. I think one of the classic disheartening things that happened in the last couple of months is the Clinton attack on Obama for, quote, talking too good and saying, well, that doesn't matter. You've got to have real solutions. That's straight out of an old anti-intellectual playbook. Why is there an opposition between speaking well and having real solutions? There isn't. There shouldn't be. If you can't educate people about your solutions, you're not going to get anywhere in public life either.
Susan Jacoby is the author of The Age of American Unreason. She spoke with Steve Paulson.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
What do you think about this age of American unreason? Are we becoming less intellectual? Why do you think it's happening? And what can we do about it? We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, George Saunders on his essay, The Brain-Dead Megaphone, and Mother Nature's Ultimate Smackdown, Bear v. Shark, as we continue to explore the dumbing down of American culture. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Not since Twain has America produced a satirist this funny. It's what the writer Zadie Smith says about George Saunders. Saunders is the author of such books as In Persuasion Nation, The Brief and Frightening Reign of Phil, and Pastoralia. In 2006, he received a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant and a Guggenheim Fellowship. His first nonfiction essay collection is called The Brain-Dead Megaphone. Here's George Saunders reading an excerpt from the title essay of The Brain-Dead Megaphone.
Imagine a party. The guests from all walks of life are not negligible. They've been around, they've lived, suffered, they own businesses, have real areas of expertise. They're talking about things that interest them, giving and taking subtle correction. Certain submerged concerns are coming to the surface and, surprise, pleasant surprise, being confirmed and seconded and assuaged by other people who've been feeling the same way. Then a guy walks in with a megaphone. He's not the smartest person at the party or the most experienced or the most articulate, but he's got that megaphone. Now say he starts talking about how much he loves early mornings in spring. What happens? Well, people turn to listen. It would be hard not to. It's only polite. And soon, in their small groups, the guests may find themselves talking about early spring mornings. Or more correctly, about the validity of Megaphone Guy's ideas about early spring mornings. Some are agreeing with him, some disagreeing, but because he's so loud, their conversations will begin to react to what he's saying. As he changes topics, so do they. If he continually uses the phrase, at the end of the day, they start using it too. If he weaves into his arguments the assumption that the west side of the room is preferable to the east, a slow westward drift will begin. These responses are predicated not on his intelligence, his unique experience of the world, his powers of contemplation, or his ability with language, but on the volume and omnipresence of his narrating voice. His main characteristic is his dominance. He crowds the other voices out. His rhetoric becomes the central rhetoric because of its unavoidability. In time, Megaphone Guy will ruin the party. The guests will stop believing in their value as guests and come to see their main role as reactors to the guy. They'll stop doing what guests are supposed to do, keep the conversation going per their own interests and concerns. They'll become passive, stop believing in the validity of their own impressions. They may not even notice they've started speaking in his diction, that their thoughts are being limbed by his. What's important to him will come to seem important to them. Now, we said Megaphone Guy isn't the smartest or most articulate or most experienced person at the party, but what if the situation is even worse than this? Let's say he hasn't carefully considered the things he's saying. He's basically just blurting things out. And even with the megaphone, he has to shout a little to be heard, which limits the complexity of what he can say. Because he feels he has to be entertaining, he jumps from topic to topic, favoring the conceptual general, we're eating more cheese cubes and loving it. The anxiety or controversy provoking, wine running out due to shadowy conspiracy, the gossipy, quickie rumored in South bathroom, and the trivial. Which quadrant of the party room do you prefer? We consider speech to be the result of thought. We have a thought, then select a sentence with which to express it. But thought also results from speech. As we grope in words towards meaning, we discover what we think. This yammering guy has, by forcibly putting his restricted language into the heads of the guests, affected the quality and coloration of the thoughts going on in there. He has, in effect, put an intelligence ceiling on the party.
It's a real extraordinary image, isn't it? It's one thing to ignore, if you can, the television over in the corner, because you can turn it off. But this party that we're at is where we all live, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think turning off the TV is an option, and it's one that I tend to use. But sometimes I think it's kind of like if you found yourself in a maze, and this maze had all kinds of shelves and tables, and every one of them was covered with some kind of junk food. You could force yourself to avoid the food, but the longer you stay in there, you know, the odds are you're going to take something and your weight's going to go up. So even though a given person can avoid it, and I suppose should avoid it, cumulatively, I think there's an effect of sort of absorption of this kind of megaphone stuff.
So when did this start happening, do you think? When did you begin to notice it for the first time?
Well, you know, this is a funny thing. An essay like this is strange because I don't have any expertise in this at all. But anecdotally, it seems to me it started sometime around the O.J. deal. The feeling is it has something to do with the 24-hour news cycle. And, you know, the sense that if you have 8 hours to say something that you should or could efficiently say in 15 minutes, this then sort of back affects the tonality of what you're saying. And I think that's when it started, and I think then it became sort of ritualized. And so now you have these, you know, the need to fill vast amounts of airtime with very little information, which is almost a recipe for vapidity.
So you're saying the O.J. trial was really about 15 minutes worth of news that turned into 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah, well, and I'm kind of a Luddite, so for me it was 0 minutes of news. You know, I mean, there's no news in Guy Kills Girl. That's been going on since the Stone Ages. You know, as Thoreau says, you can basically take any newspaper from any time, and there's going to be an earthquake or a scandal or a murder or a fire, and the only difference is the proper nouns. So really, there was no news. And likewise, you know, this is sort of a commonplace, but you look at a thing like Anna Nicole Smith, there's no news. There's nothing to be seen there. Except the kind of, you know, accident-watching gossip sort of mode.
Right. But people actually got interested in this. I can remember going to restaurants where they had the O.J. trial on.
Sure. The truth is, if you put two mice on television, eventually people would get interested. Did you see what Whitey did? You know, it isn't really – I mean, human beings love narrative, and we'll find it anywhere. So I think probably if the old man in me recedes a little bit – it's always been fun to gossip and to think morbid thoughts and so on. So I'm not really even against it. But I think when it begins to erode the entire fabric of the culture, then we might want to reexamine a little bit.
Well, and as you put it in the essay, when the media identifies someone as an expert, we just kind of assume their area of expertise is important.
I think, you know, there's something funny about the way that the format drives content. So we find ourselves talking about things that in our private lives we'd probably never talk about, or if we felt inclined to, we might have the self-discipline to avoid it. But you sort of dress it up, and you make it look good and sound good, and suddenly it does have a kind of authority. And again, I don't suppose there's anything wrong with it, but I became aware of this around the time of the Iraq War, when the same tonality that was in format that had been developed for O.J. to expand that non-story was being used to talk about this incredibly important thing. And it struck me as a failure of culture, because what culture is supposed to do is at that critical moment when you're deciding whether to invade a place, all the resources of the nation, all the wisdom of the nation should be brought to bear. And within that very, very weird limiting format, driven by people, you know, like O'Reilly and so on, we didn't get all of our resources to the table. You know, the normal resources you would use when you're trying to figure out whether to kill somebody, and we were trying to figure out, as it turns out, whether to kill hundreds of thousands of people, the spiritual, ethical, artistic concerns that are not baby games, serious stuff, that never got brought to the table, in part, I would argue, because of the restrictive entertainment-driven format in which we were having this discussion.
It's one thing when Megaphone Guy is at the party speaking about how he feels about early mornings in spring, But when it starts to be a discussion of whether we ought to go to war and whether, as a result, several thousand people will die, you suddenly get angry that that megaphone is drowning out the discussion.
Absolutely, because we've taken, you know, thousands and thousands of years to develop things like art and literature and so on. And probably in our culture, we've come to see those as ornamental or, you know, as indulgences. But the truth is they were first developed in order to bring to bear the entire human consciousness to these decisions in incredibly nuanced, sophisticated ways. And so we discount those at our own peril. And I think now we sort of start to see the fallout of that. And also, you know, it's clear that these format issues we're talking about are primarily economic manifestations. There's nobody saying, oh, it's much more beautiful or kind of charming or intelligent if we do it this way. It's clearly being driven by economics. So it seems to me that's something, you know, that should be examined.
Talking about Iraq, you said that it was a literary failure. You mean it's a failure because all of this is about storytelling and we're not telling good stories anymore?
No. I mean it's a failure of imagination. That one of the things we do historically when deciding whether to invade a country or have an affair or, you know, have a child out of wedlock or whatever is that we examine these things with all our resources of imagination. And one of the ways we make that decision is to imagine the actual complex reality on the other end of the missile. This is not as easy as it sounds. I mean, if I say, you know, I'm sitting here in Syracuse, let me imagine Madison. Well, I've been there a couple times. I don't remember much. I can remember two or three sort of vague street scenes. That's all I can really summon up of Madison. So if I have a missile aimed at Madison, what literature lets me do, if I've trained myself in it, is get past my initial boneheaded projection into a more detailed three-dimensional projection of what's actually on the other end. And I think that's where it was a literary failure. We have the resources in our country to make those decisions with a complex imagination. But because we trusted what I'm calling megaphone guy, we made that decision on the thinnest, most ridiculous little projection that had to do with words like WMD and, you know, bouquets will be thrown and so on. So that's why I say it's a literary failure. We needed to use our literary capabilities to fully imagine what we were about to do.
So what do we do with megaphone guy? I mean, he's here, frankly, and he's not going to go anywhere. So you've got the guy with the megaphone. You try to, what, tone him down?
Well, one thing I think you try to do is not be him, which we all are. I mean, I'm probably doing it right this minute. But I think, you know, when Barack Obama gave his speech on race, I thought that was a beautiful illustration of the ways that in incremental ways each of us can sort of participate. That speech was so honest and articulate and bold that it sort of made a beautiful case for being articulate and for being frank and for the ability of language to go into these incredibly nuanced, difficult places. So I think really, in some ways, the end of the essay is a fizzle because basically I say, well, there's this big problem. There's this horrible guy, megaphone guy. Revise your work. You know, that, I mean, and it is a little bit of a letdown. But honestly, I think that's really, like so many things, you know, you can sort of propose the USA Today solution. We're getting more articulate. But I think in reality, it's just a, you know, it's a slog. It's each of us recognizing that, you know, precision is important and that revision is important. And also calling a spade, you know, some of the most refreshing things that happened during that crazy post 9/11 period. I remember Tom Daschle and Al Gore on the same weekend both saying, no fair, you can't simply call everyone who disagrees with you, President Bush, unpatriotic. And I remember just getting this rush of adrenaline like, oh, thank God someone spoke the truth. You know, we shouldn't underestimate these small victories because actually they're not all that small.
George Saunders is the author of a collection of essays called The Brain Dead Megaphone.
And one more thing.
Can I teach a country? Oh, baby, can I teach a country? Oh, baby, can I teach a country?
The question is simple, as are most profound questions. Given a relatively level playing field, water deep enough so that a shark could maneuver proficiently, but shallow enough so that a bear could stand and operate with its characteristic dexterity, who would win in a fight between a bear and a shark?
That's Chris Batchelder with an excerpt from his debut novel, Bear v. Shark. Batchelder talked to Anne Strangechamps about Bear v. Shark, the novel.
Futuristic, sort of, although sort of the moment as well. Scenario in which a bear and a shark are going to get in a fight in the Darwin Dome in Las Vegas, which has seceded from the Union to form its own sovereign, independent nation based on entertainment and fun. And the main family, the Normans, there's a husband and a wife and two children, two boys. The youngest son wins an essay contest on Bear v. Shark and what it means to him, what it means to America, and they get four tickets and they drive to Las Vegas to see the fight. So it's a road novel of sorts.
So the Bear v. Shark contest has become, it's not just any old contest, this has become a huge public spectacle?
Right. You know, it's the Super Bowl times 100. Yeah, it's a gigantic televised and, yeah, gigantic spectacle in the Darwin Dome.
And this is not the first time the bear has fought the shark or the shark has fought the bear,
right?
That's right. This is actually a rematch.
That's right. It's a rematch. This is Bear v. Shark 2, you know, and the animals are computer-generated, actually. They're not even real animals. And in the first matchup, the bear, allegedly the bear's head was too small, and it was mauled fairly quickly. And so this is a rematch and for the bear's revenge. This is very silly.
Why aren't they real animals?
Well, the book is concerned at many levels about the binary between the real and the artificial, and this goes toward, you know, real connection versus artificial connection and real family versus artificial family, meaningful community versus artificial community. And that, so this is just one other way I can play with that binary, is to not only is this a ridiculous and absurd and superficial and violent matchup, but it's not even real. They're computer generated, and I guess this allows for the possibility of corporate tinkering as well and corporate malfeasance and getting involved in, you know, the programming of the animals and who might win.
One of the things that makes this book so much fun to read is that the story of the novel itself is constantly interrupted by fake talk show, I guess real talk shows, a list of patents pending. I believe there are some corporate companies that are already looking ahead to the future of Bear v. Shark. They're imagining Toddler v. Snake or Hitler v. Elvis.
Right.
One of my favorites is Middle Manager v. Homeless. So what made you decide to structure the book this way with all these little kind of commercial breaks?
Well, I mean, it just occurs to me that one of the things that about television is you think that the commercials are the breaks, but the commercials are paying for everything, right? So it's really, it's the advertisers trying to get you in front of your television for the commercials. That's the real show. And then, you know, whatever's around it in the 22 minutes around it in, say, a sitcom, that's not the actually why you're sitting there. You're sitting there for the ads. So there's a reverse there of, you know, the narrative versus the advertisements and these other things coming in from the side. But also, you know, it's 100 chapters. This is the small chapter is a comic form. Kurt Vonnegut talked about it as his short chapters as little mouse traps that he would set the trap and then spring it, set the trap and then spring it over and over. It's a way to set up a joke and then finish the joke. So I was attracted to that as well. And, you know, it's also kind of a age-old strategy of appropriating the strategies and techniques and modes of the enemy, you know, when you're writing satire. And I'm satirizing entertainment culture, so I'm using the tactics and strategies of entertainment culture. I think this is a dangerous tactic in many ways. I'm not convinced it's the best way to go, but that's what I was up to.
What makes you think it's a dangerous tactic?
Well, I think it's the paradox of trying to write an entertaining book about entertainment. The danger is that you write something as absurd, as ephemeral, as superficial, and as dumb as the thing that you're satirizing. You know, the book's out of print, you know. So, I mean, I'm proud of the book as a first novel, but the strategy seems to me, looking back, to be a little bit dangerous for that reason.
There's a chapter in Bear v. Shark called Non Sequitur. It's chapter 54. I wonder, could you read that for us?
A television personality says, "Okay, we just have about 30 seconds left. Tell us about your new self-published book." The new self-published book author says, "My main point, Carol, is that our culture's information practices have just about done away with the concept of a non sequitur. In other words, we now fully expect things not to follow from other things, such that when things do not follow from other things, they seem to follow quite naturally from other things. The television personality says, "Well, you lost me, I'm afraid." The new self-published book author says the real non sequitur has perhaps become the sequitur, so to speak. The television personality says, "Whoa, the sequitur, huh?" The television show director says, 5 seconds. The television show producer says, "Remind me never to have another author on the show." The new self-published book author says, "When a point follows from another point, it seems not to follow at all because we expect it not to follow, and when it doesn't, it seems as if it does because we expected it not to." That's a wrap. The television commercial says, "If you have lung cancer, would you rather go to some general practitioner or to a lung cancer specialist? At Green Paint, we don't just dabble in greens like other paint companies. Green is what we do. So whether you need a lime or a forest, a pea or a hunter, a sage or a Kelly, come to Green Paint, where green has been a specialty for over 20 years. And remember, we do lawns."
Yeah, so in fact, although the business about sequitur versus non sequitur is a little hard to follow, the ad is the perfect example of it, right?
Right, exactly. You can tell I had some fun. I had some fun with this book.
So is there a deeper point you're making here about sequiturs and non sequiturs and the weird way our culture works now?
Well, yeah, I hope I'm up to something larger, but there's no gradual building of argument. Things are placed together, you know, quickly, and there's no, I think it's Postman who brings this up, and not to refer to some golden age where everybody was smarter and more reasonable. You know, he talked about the Lincoln-Douglas debates and how people were sitting in hot rooms or cold rooms for 8, 10, 12 hours a day and listening to arguments and weighing them and, you know, sifting evidence. And, you know, things are much less so these days. And this is the non sequitur gag is about this sort of movement from one thing to another. It's a lunatic, really, but it's become our sort of central cultural practice.
Yeah, so our culture works by association. You know, you just set two things together, and it's dangerous because our politics works by association, too, increasingly.
Right, and less by, you know, reasoned argument, evidence, you know, rhetorical skill.
Do you think this kind of media-saturated, dumbed-down culture is beyond fixing, or can you imagine that changing?
Well, I wouldn't want to be so pessimistic as to say it couldn't. It's beyond fixing, but I think it is so central to a web of a different ideological strands that it couldn't be fixed in isolation. It's so connected to other cultural and political, economic factors, and so part of American ideology that I don't think it could. Yeah, I don't think in isolation you can just say, "All right, let's set out to change the media." I mean, in a way, we've got the media that we want and deserve.
Chris Batchelder is the author of Bear v. Shark, the novel. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps. Al Franken is an Emmy Award-winning comedian, actor, author, radio host, and political candidate. He hosted the flagship program on the Air America radio network from 2004 until 2007. One of Franken's radio innovations was the audio crawl, radio's version of the crawl or ticker, the news headlines that run along the bottom of your TV screen. Here's Al Franken and his co-host, Catherine Lanfear, with the audio crawl.
How was your weekend, Catherine?
It was all right. It was
dead.
Quiet. You know, nothing
Harvard
like
study
what
linked
you
smoking
did.
With reduced
you know.
Bone
well, what
density,
I did was pretty,
women 50
pretty
plus.
Exciting.
Singer Beyonce Knowles is 27.
Went down to the White House correspondent. And you know, I went down on the shuttle.
The show was fun, but it's time to move on.
Sat with John Podoretz.
Air America introduces
who's very conservative. Columnist.
Reuters.
The New York Post.
New
we had a lovely time.
Vancouver.
Talking.
Wider
His wife, Ayella, actually
study.
Is
most Americans
the talent
unable to listen
coordinator
to
for Saturday Night Live.
Beyonce Knowles is 27 today.
The whole... Okay, Billy, forget it.
Athens mayor says city will be ready for upcoming...
No. No, Billy, no.
The audio crawl from Al Franken's Air America radio show. Well, what do you think? Could the audio crawl work on public radio? And what do you think of the current state of the media? Who are you rooting for? Bear or shark? I'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll look at how today's internet is killing our culture as we conclude our hour on the dumbing down of our culture. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Andrew Keen is a Silicon Valley entrepreneur. He's also the author of a book called The Cult of the Amateur, How Today's Internet is Killing Our Culture.
The subtitle of my book is perhaps a rather vulgar exaggeration in the sense that the subtitle of the book says How Today's Internet is Killing Our Culture. But of course, Web 2.0 is us. So today's internet is us. So we're killing our culture.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about the Web 2.0 revolution, the internet today, MySpace, YouTube, Wikipedia, and so on and so forth, is that it's a mirror. When we look at it, we're looking at ourselves. And when I see it, I'm disturbed and disappointed.
The big difference, it seems to me, between then and now, if you will, and the internet reflects this, is that it is so much easier to get information out. It isn't as though there wasn't always misinformation available.
The problem is there's two things going on in parallel, and these things are causally connected, although it's hard to argue that one necessarily causes the other. On the one hand, we have the rise of user-generated media, the Web 2.0 revolution. And on the other hand, we have an economic and in some senses, I think, a cultural crisis of mainstream media. Fewer and fewer people are reading newspapers, listening to the radio. The music business is in free fall. The television business is in crisis, although in my view, that's not necessarily a bad thing. So what is happening is that the old institutions, the old edifices of mainstream culture, the things that we relied on for our information, are going away. And all that is left is user-generated content. Now, I think it would be unfair to argue that user-generated content is killing mainstream media, but the rise of one and the fall of another are intimately bound up with one another.
Well, there are a lot of people who would say that the mainstream media deserves this, that it's corrupt, it's gotten lazy, a lot of what you see and hear and read in the mainstream media isn't worth seeing or hearing or reading, and so the opportunity for bright, energetic people to come in and make it more honest, more wise, if you will, makes sense. I gather that you're having a hard time not laughing as I'm saying that.
We're at the Judy Miller moment in the interview, aren't we, where you tell me about Judy Miller as this corrupt New York Times journalist, and I'm supposed to say, well, not all journalists are like that. You don't, quite frankly, sound, I mean, I don't know you that well, but you don't sound either lazy or incompetent.
Well, I don't feel lazy or incompetent, and I think, in fact, you know, radio is still doing pretty well if you look at what's going on, although...
Well, in economic terms, is it doing well? I mean, are more and more, is it easier and easier to actually make money? I think the thing about mainstream media is that there's a broader cultural context to this. We, for one reason or another, and these are broad sort of sociocultural phenomenon, we don't trust authorities anymore. We don't trust people in power. So just as we increasingly are skeptical of politicians, people who hold political power, so I think we've become increasingly skeptical of people who hold cultural power, whether it's in Hollywood, at the record labels, at the newspapers. We tend to use any excuse, a Judy Miller excuse, one rotten apple in a huge barrel of high-quality apples to argue that everything's wrong. And the reality, I think, whether it's radio or newspapers, even the music business, the reality is that the majority of professional journalists and professional media people do an honest and competent job. They're trained, they're serious, and they bring significant value to our culture.
I'm obviously not going to argue with you on this subject.
You should tell me I'm wrong. I mean, the funny thing is that, and there's, a curious irony to this, is that I'm not a mainstream media guy. You know, I'm a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, but my book is the first attempt to actually defend mainstream media. And a lot of mainstream media people have come up to me and said, we really agree with what you're saying. But because I think of the broader cultural context, it's very hard for mainstream media people to stick up for themselves. And one of the lessons in my book, one of the things that I want to tell mainstream media people is they need to be more authoritative. They need to explain to people the value they bring. They shouldn't be as apologetic as I think they've become.
Let's talk about the online collaborative encyclopedia, Wikipedia. You've got mixed feelings about it, right?
Mixed feelings are fair. I'm not a complete Wikipedia basher. I've debated Jimmy Wales in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago, and I said to him, if you were willing to force your users to reveal who they are in terms of their anonymity, to pare the veil away, to reveal themselves, then I think that Wikipedia becomes a much more viable resource. I also think that Wikipedia needs to be monetized. I think that the contributors on it should be paid for their content. I'm not in favor of experts giving away their content. Wikipedia has a lot of potential. I have to admit that I use it myself, even if I'm a critic. It's a good first stop. The problem, my concern, in the Web 2.0 age is that in an age where people are less and less media literate, less and less able to discriminate between different kinds of media, less and less skeptical, they're more and more reliant on Wikipedia. So it's fine for my generation that has been brought up in Britannica and knows the difference between an expert-created piece of content and something on Wikipedia. It's not fine for this latest generation.
So your biggest complaint about Wikipedia is that it is produced largely by amateurs rather than professionals.
My biggest complaint with Wikipedia is it's produced by people who I don't know who they are. It's produced by anonymous people. All knowledge has cultural, social context. There's no such thing, as we all know, as absolute truth. All knowledge creators come with cultural and socioeconomic baggage. If you are media literate, you have to understand who those people are, and you take that into account. The problem with Wikipedia is when I look at an entry on, I don't know, Andrew Keen, for example, I don't know who is contributing to it. I have no idea of those people, so I have no idea of critically, skeptically evaluating the quality of the content. The thing about Wikipedia is that people aren't actually doing their research. They're simply believing without critical sort of evaluation what other people are saying. But, I mean, the entry on Andrew Keen is neither here nor there. What's really interesting on Wikipedia, and this, again, explains its weakness, is that there's no one in control. No one is making a distinction between important subjects and, at best, marginal or footnoted subjects. When you go to Wikipedia, the entry on Stephen Colbert's joke, his notion of truthiness, which is a funny joke about sort of the relativized knowledge, and it's all part of his act as this radical right-wing TV pundit, is almost as long and as meticulously researched as the entry on truth, the core concept in the history of Western philosophy. When you don't have anyone in charge, when there's no central editor, when there's no one saying, well, look, truth is the core concept, the whole history of Western philosophy revolves around that, that deserves a very significant entry and a lot of work, versus truthiness, which is a footnote to a reasonably popular early 21st century television comedian, then nobody really knows how to evaluate the importance of information.
Now, I guess what happened is at the beginning of Web 2.0, there were a lot of people who felt that there were too many authoritative figures who were deciding what it was that we were allowed to know, and this was an opportunity to share knowledge. You're suggesting that we need some oversight, and yet it comes back to the question of who decides, doesn't it?
It comes back to the question of who decides, which is ultimately an age-old question. Again, it's a question that philosophers have been arguing about for 2,000 or 3,000 years. The problem, I think, with that is it's a legitimate question and a very interesting question. I acknowledge that. But the problem is that it's a philosophical question and a political question. It's not a question that should be wrecking media. So sure, discuss it. But the purpose of media is as a vehicle for the distribution of reliable information and high-quality entertainment. Yeah. The problem with the Web 2.0 movement is they're treating media as an engineering tool for righting socioeconomic wrongs. And that's a mistake. Media becomes the victim of this latest version of creating a perfectly fair playing field in terms of our opportunity. It becomes the experiment for building a perfect meritocracy, which in my view can never be done and will never be done.
So, I mean, we've talked about this. We've found the horrors of Web 2.0. What do we do? What do you think needs to be done to address the problems? Because the technology is not going away.
No, the technology is not going away. And the technology isn't necessarily bad. I think the first thing we need to remind ourselves is that we have created this technology. There's nothing inevitable about it. And if it really is creating forces that are bad for our culture, if it really is resulting in newspapers shutting down, and all we have to rely on are our own personal networks on Facebook, then that's a bad thing. Then we need to reevaluate newspapers. We need to perhaps think of them as museums or schools or parks, think of them more as a social benefit. A couple of other things I think we need to remind ourselves about. We need to reevaluate or rethink this cultural assault on expertise and on authority. Because I think that at a certain point, we need to take a stand against it. It will infiltrate the classroom. It will infiltrate the university lecture hall. It will infiltrate the corporation, the enterprise. I think we need to remind ourselves that if you spend 20, 30, 40 years training to do something, then you're going to be better at it than the amateur. We have to fight against this cult of innocence, this idea that the less you know, the more you know, and that people who are trained, who are professionals, are somehow suspect that they're corrupt or self-interested. The other thing, most of all, I think we need to remind ourselves is that if something's good, we need to pay for it. Because if we don't pay for it, ultimately it will go away. You get what you pay for. And the free garbage on MySpace and YouTube and Wikipedia is what you pay for, which is nothing. So if we really care about newspapers or movies or books, we need to remind ourselves that we need to pay for those movies, newspapers, and books, because that is the way that the journalists and the filmmakers and the musicians get paid.
Andrew Keen is the author of The Cult of the Amateur, How Today's Internet is Killing Our Culture. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 46A, Dumbing Down, Smartening Up. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strange Champs, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.